The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Anticipating the Trivium with your 3-year-old. Although I intend the application to be well beyond that, a few disclaimers before I introduce myself and offer prayers for this session. The first is, this talk, unlike one talk I heard today, is very much from the perspective of poetic truth, as I understood the conference topic and theme to be given. So this is not a talk I would have written had the conference theme been different. I just warn you. So it is poetic. It's my attempt to be poetic about our PK3 program at the Academy. So there's that. Okay. By way of introduction, my name is Nathan Carr. I'm headmaster at the Academy of Classical Christian Studies of Oklahoma City. It's a multi-campus school of classics that blends both 2- and 3-day-a-week instruction with our professors with 5-day-a-week instruction for over 600 students. So it's a multifaceted little school there in OKC. Oh, yeah, I'm supposed to turn this on. Cool. And then I'm also a vicar of a small church in Oklahoma City and a dad of 6. And you're going to hear about 2 of my kiddos today in the course of my talk. With that said, would you join me in prayer? Our Heavenly Father, who has given us the great joy and care of children, give us strength, light and strength, so to train them in whatsoever things are true and good and beautiful, of good report, that they may follow after thee all the days of their life and be salt and light in the communities in which you enfold them. Grant us now the wisdom which we seek, which comes only from above. And this we pray through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen. So I'm one of those people who feels like the past is some great dare. I've always been the small kid with the skinny arm. Picturing myself in this case at the great frisbee throw of this life. This life metaphorically must, in fact, be a frisbee throw. And who steps up next to me for his own turn? Someone like Dante Alighieri, right? His muscles bulge through his sleeves. He's more than a head taller. He's far more brilliant. He's even genuinely devout. He throws rather effortlessly a 100-yard perfect spiral frisbee, takes the platform of the great awards assembly of this life, and I'm the guy standing nameless in the crowds thinking, oh yeah, not the best perspective. This happened to me again at the hand of my assistant headmaster, Dr. Schutt here. Whose talk is tomorrow? You should go. He was giving a talk at our admin retreat this last January, and he quoted one of these dares to me from David Hall's book, Worlds of Wonder, Days of Judgment. In talking about the homes of these early American Puritans, Hall writes this: literacy was achieved within the household with mothers as the key instructors. So far, so good on the dare factor. Here took place instruction in the catechism, and here young children first learned how to read. Not every family practiced the routine of family devotions that included daily readings from the Bible, but every household in New England was at least affected by the premise, originating with the Reformation, that all godly people should be literate. In late 16th century England, towns that came beneath the sway of, quote, Puritans, his quotes, I love it, enacted statutes requiring every household to become a little school. I love the Puritans, man. So too, in New England, the religious system merged with households in ways that ensured a near universal literacy. All well and good. There's some dare there. They've outpaced me, yes. You know, but I can catch up with a little Book of Common Prayer here and a little classical Christian education there, you know. Then Dr. Schutt read this. Cotton Mather. Wait, why did his face not pop up? Oh, there he is. Cotton Mather may have been presumptuous in suggesting to a friend that his son begin to read before he is 2 years old. But there is evidence of children going off to school when they were not much older. Henry Sewell set out for dame school hand in hand with an older sister at the grand age of 3. John Bernard went to dame school when he was 3 or 4 years old. Bernard also remembered that, quote, I had read my Bible through thrice by the age of 6. The stories of pious children that Thomas White retold assume that children no more than 3 or 4 years old were readers. And at whatever age it came, literacy arrived without much formal schooling. Now that was a dare to me. I no sooner had heard that than did I open a PK3 class at the academy and enroll 25 students just to see if it could be done, right? To be honest, we'd already opened the program. But the dare enhanced my fervor to keep it open since we were in a pilot phase of PK3. It can be done. We'll get to how much literacy later can be done, at least in Oklahoma City. But we didn't do it in the way that I've just described, necessarily. So a page from Puritanical writings, but not the whole hog, you'll see. We'll get there. And not with the materials that I thought we'd use. And my second disclaimer of the day, much of the story has yet to be written. We're 2 years in. But I will tell you what little I know. So, step number one. Call a Lebanese Orthodox Christian named Warren Farha. This is very specific advice. Who started America's Greatest Bookstore, Eighth Day Books. It's here. You should check it out. That's step number one. I already had a 3-year-old in my home with which to experiment. Let's see if I can get that up. I was a bit of a hummingbird at this point in the process of establishing a PK3 program, invisible wings flapping as I dashed from one Kool-Aid dispenser to the next for nectar, stationary for all of 4.8 seconds at each place, trying to find my way through preschool. So first stop from friend Warren, unexpected, the Fairy Book Series, edited by Andrew Lang. It is for sale on the Eighth Day Book Table. I first needed to understand the fabric and the architecture of the 3-year-old soul. I needed some heroes, I needed some villains, and quite a few fairies to make this work. Certainly the worksheets and crayons and songs and ditties about the 10 plagues could come later. So, with my 6 children circled round our coffee table, and with my 3-year-old bouncing from one knee to the next, we began with the story of Cannetella. Do you know the story of Cannetella? She is in the Gray Fairy Book. Each of the the Fairy Book volumes, as you see them here, and they are labeled by color, and they are the fairy tales. He has edited these 17th century, I believe, from every corner of the world into a single series so that you can read the fairy tales that have shaped the minds of three-year-olds since time began. All right. There was once upon a time a king who reigned over a country, I read. Giggles. The girls knew what was coming. And he had a daughter, said my three-year-old. Continued reading. He was very rich and powerful, had everything in the world he could desire except a child. But at last, after he had been married for many years and was quite an old man, his wife, Renzola, presented him with a fine daughter whom they called Canatella. My daughter knew it. She dashed upstairs to quickly change into a tattered princess dress-up dress that all three of my daughters have used to play house, to play fort, to play family, and to play school. I continued reading. She grew up into a beautiful girl, was as tall and as straight as a young fir tree. And all my girls sat up in their chairs. When she was 18 years old, her father called her to him and said, "You are of an age now, my daughter, to marry and settle down, but as I love you more than anything else in the world and desire nothing but your happiness, I am determined to leave the choice of a husband to yourself. Choose a man after your own heart, and you are sure to satisfy me." Canatella thanked her father very much for his kindness and consideration, but told him that she had not the slightest wish to marry and was quite determined to remain single. My seven-year-old daughter smirked. Trouble is a brewing in the Renzola family. We actually have some plot here. Good news for kiddos who are tired of little house board books, where the great tragedy is that sister dropped her doll on the floor. So keep reading, they would say. What are we to do with an old, feeble king whose only daughter rejects his one request in 18 years? Canatella, who figures she can negotiate her way out of this with the standard of heaven alone, finally agrees, "Well, very well, dear father. I will marry to please you, for if I do not wish to appear ungrateful for all your love and kindness, but you must find me a husband cleverer, and more charming than anyone else in the world." Sounds like a purity conference for adolescent girls at my old church, really. Like, hold out for St. Timothy himself. And all the boys, including me, leave depressed, you know, like knowing we'll never get a date at this church. Because we all had bad attitudes sometimes and really junky cars. And we sometimes forgot to stand when a lady left the table. Yeah, we'd stumble awkwardly through public prayer, not knowing what to say in front of such royalty. Anyway, so her father, King, brings a few strapping young lads around, and she finds fatal flaw in each. I mean, one guy was so obtuse as to let an almond accidentally fall out of his mouth at the meal. The poor loser. So the king, exasperated, finally lets loose. "If that's all you have against him, Canatella, I see how the land lies. You are determined not to have a husband at all, but marry someone you shall, for I do not mean my name and house to die out." My girls, including my three-year-old, are now silent at this awkward exchange. We are high-centered on Canatella's stubbornness, and no one knows why she is being so fussy. Irony here, right? Apparently, the meal that we had just enjoyed an hour before we read Canatella, is now ancient history, in which my three-year-old had waged the battle of the bulge over the last noodle on her plate because a microscopic piece of spinach was seen clinging to one side. But we don't know why Canatella's making such a fuss over this marriage thing. I mean, it was an almond, for crying out loud. Well, Canatella negotiates the following. Well then, my dear parent, that was different than last time. It was my dear loving and caring father. Well then, my dear parent, I must tell you at once that you had better not count upon me, for I never mean to marry unless I can find a man with a gold head and gold teeth. Close quote. Bad move. Number one, word gets out fast with that sort of lame criteria in magical kingdoms. Number two, this is a land filled with magic, including wicked wizards. And that is not a bit different. This may be my first point with regard to three-year-olds. Magic kingdoms, that is not a bit different than our own world. This girl is sunk. Good kings, her daddy, have deadly enemies, and his name in this story is Schioravanti. Schioravante. Duplicity himself. He knows how to cast spells that give him a gold head and gold teeth, and he makes sure that he is waltzing past the palace one evening while the king sits outside observing his kingdom. The king, stop a minute, brother, and don't be in such a desperate haste. If you will step in here, you shall have my daughter for a wife, and I will send attendants with her and as many horses and servants as you wish. Done. They were married, and no sooner are they hitched than Schioravante whisks her away to his own kingdom, never to be heard from again. She now lives with the horses in his stable, eating what they leave behind and wishing things had gone very differently. And he always leaves for 7 years at a time. Instructive. So I always, at the low point in a story, this is all leading somewhere, by the way. We're going to have some brass tacks at the end. It's just not how I begin anything. So here we go. All right. I always shut the book at the low point and say, and that concludes our story. Let's go ahead and say evening prayers, just so that they cry out that there's no possible way this is how a story could ever end. So I open the story back up. So let's wrap up this story so at least you know what happens with Canatella. I hate to leave you hanging. Months later, she finds a crack in the wall of her prison. This really is some of the best parts with my children. And she sees a beautiful garden with all manner of delicious fruits and flowers growing in it. I pause the story. I rarely pause the story, but I just can't get over the parallelism here, right? What is that like, I ask? The Garden of Eden, my firstborn says. Bingo. She's 12. My kids now know, because of Areta, their older sister, that this is a story about the way the whole world works. It is rooted in the mother story, which dictates how every other story ever told is going to play out, if it is to be remembered. So our daddy now is Almighty God, which is helpful. She slips out of the stall, back to Canatella, takes, eats, and enjoys. Husband returns from a 7-year trip, gets furious with Schioravante, but he keeps leaving for these increments. So after he chastises her, that gives her 7 more years to plan yet another escape. One of the kings, her father's cooper's barrel maker, happens to be passing through, has compassion, puts her into a big empty barrel, delivers her to her father. The expected shock and horror of her father ensue. But she's now changed her story and says the following bit of gospel truth, and I quote from Canatella, "It is enough that I am once more with you, Father, and I shall never leave you again, for I would rather be a slave in your house than queen in any other." Close quote. Slam dunk. OKC Thunder, all the way to the national championship. Slam dunk. That did not happen. We can all go home and go to bed now. We can't. Schioravante is still out there. My 3-year-old falls off the arm of the chair in suspense the moment Sierra Vontae is on his way back, because we just don't want to have to deal with that final chapter. He finds his way through this layered maze of protection placed round her to claim his rightful bride. And as she screams in horror, Canatella, he seizes upon the bed on which she lay to carry her away, when the charm that he had placed that got him through these several corridors falls to the ground. When things fall to the ground in fairy tales, it's bad. You know this. The people of the palace rush in. They kill Schiaravante on the spot. And the tale ends with this moral, quote, "So he was caught in the trap which he had laid for the princess. And is so, as is so often the case in this world, the biter himself was bit." Close quote. The colored pencils now lay strewn all over the rug. My 2-year-old son, who has no idea what's going on, has instead torn someone's coloring page to shreds and stuffed it under a chair, an injustice we'll have to deal with immediately. There's an outcry. It's now time for evening prayer, and my 2 youngest daughters say, "Dad, can we read one more?" And those daughters are ages 7 and 3. So go, Warren Farha of 8th Day Books. So step one of building a 3-year-old program, ours is centered around this very thing, that properly anticipates, if not outright enacts, much of the trivium, is to orient the whole thing around stories that tell them how the world works, stories that tell them how their soul is made, and make sure it is filled with evil. Because we've got a cure for that, and we want that to be instinctual in them. Education is the handmaiden of that enterprise. It is the great bridesmaid of the one church of Jesus Christ. And your children, especially your 3-year-olds, hopefully your seniors as well, are fairies in a fairy world. All right. I think I missed some slides in there. Maybe not. What's the next one? No, I didn't. All right, step 2. We're going to wake the dead with air guitars. Air guitars being a trope for imaginary play. Vegan Gurion, in his Tending the Heart of Virtue, also available at 8th Day Books, quotes Flannery O'Connor as having said the following. Quote, "A story is a way to say something that cannot be said any other way. You tell a story because a statement would be inadequate." Close quote. You are inviting the eye roll in your 3-year-old classroom if you simply say to Olive Kate, my 3-year-old, "You, young lady, are resisting my role as king in this family by not eating your spinach-laced noodle to your room, young princess." Or if I were to say, "Olive Kate, evil is entrapped by its own snares, so resist it." Both lessons from Canatella, if not just the first 2 of many. If her moral imagination exists at all, it is likely the size of a peanut. And my job as a parent, and a little bit as headmaster, but mainly as a parent, is to enlarge that thing to the size of an ocean. We will not get there with propositions quite yet that invite her acceptance when her world is filled with dolls, with magic umbrellas. I wish you could see the magic umbrella in her family. It is so worn out. Potions made with grass clippings and Oklahoma red dirt, and old quilts that live on the side porch that double as palace roofs every day in the front yard. But we might get there with Canatella. We just might get there. Vegan goes on, or Gurion goes on, he says, quote, "Mere instruction in morality is not sufficient to nurture the virtues." In quoting that, I'm obviously assuming some things about what your school exists to teach. So I'm assuming a massive front end at your school of developing the moral imagination. And again, we'll get to concrete ways of doing that, but I'm assuming that in the things that I'm quoting. But that's how I've approached it. He continues, Gurion, it might even backfire, especially when the presentation is heavily exhortative and the pupil's will is coerced. Maybe Canatella's response to her father initially, coercive will. Instead, a compelling vision of the goodness of goodness itself needs to be presented in a way that is attractive and stirs the imagination. A good moral education addresses both the cognitive and affective dimensions of human nature. Stories are an irreplaceable medium for this kind of moral education. That is the education of character. Of course, the Greek word for character literally means impression, something I will return to in a minute in the writings of John Chrysostom. So, step two summary. Educating three-year-olds is primarily about the affective dimension, affections, the moral imagination, and to get there, we must wake the dead. So let me give you an example of how this plays out. Two summers ago, I transitioned our family for the summer. God help the children of priests, from readings of red letter saints on feast days to street saints, a fun new chapter in saints, readings. I had purchased a book by the same name, written by the wonderful Barbara Elliott, in which she outlines, I've got a picture over here, in which she outlines the lives of current heroes in the urban core of American cities, doing rather remarkable work to renew dangerous neighborhoods for the sake of the kingdom of Christ. One story of a Houston hero who had converted an abandoned Kmart into a local hub of ministries, including a church, a rehab clinic for those experiencing the worst kinds of withdrawal, job training, a school, and so on, had apparently made a deep impression on my children, my three-year-old included. I didn't know it at the time of reading it. They seemed to respond to it like any other story. But the next day, I climbed the stairway upstairs to investigate the unusual silence of some 2 hours. Usually, 2 hours of silence in our 8-member home means that a bit of funny business is taking place somewhere. Either they're painting the walls with pastels, that has taken place, or they are dumping Legos into an air conditioning vent to see how many will fit. That has taken place. That's not what I found this day. Laid out on the ground was a felt rug that had streets, something usually used in our home for Hot Wheels races. You see these roll-out rugs? Okay, all right. In the middle of it were a series of Lincoln log homes. Decent job on the homes. Some of them lacked roofs, but, this is an urban renewal project, right? I later figure out. And there is a large building made of antique blocks that my mother had given my children. Inside the building, they had built Lego cots where lay Lego stormtroopers and pirates going through the pangs of withdrawal, while Lego hobbits and Chewbacca held their hands as they lay sweating and vomiting. There was a grocery store and a school as well on the rug. So thank you, Gurion, and thank you, Barbara Elliott, for a page from the three-year-old soul. I hope that you see in all of this that I am in no way a professional. I'm not a professional parent. I hope you see how providentially accidental all of this is. Build, wherever you are, the institution of a family. Build the institution of a school with a bit of whimsy. You can incorporate that as official educational philosophy. Love institutions that can play while maintaining utter condemnation for institutionalism. I say that as a priest. Now, so you can still teach a kid to be silent for the story and then experience hyperventilating laughter for the play, where they are falling over in stitches as part of official scripted lesson planning. All right. Step 3, prepare well your insignia and your seal as you playfully and prayerfully press it into the wax of their lives, the lives of these 3-year-olds. That I picked up that wax, a waxen idea as a metaphor from St. John Chrysostom. He has a sermon entitled An Address on Vainglory and the Right Way for Parents to Bring Up Their Children. He is a fourth century church father, Bishop of Constantinople, and displays some of the greatest work toward the classical Christian synthesis that we seek in our schools, that you will find. You can find that sermon online, by the way, fully translated from Greek. Chrysostom sets his sights upon the coming generation in his exhortation on child rearing, obviously, right? Parenting is, in a very real way, your statement of saying there is a way of life that is worthy of immortality. And that is the arc of this sermon. There is a way of life worthy of immortality because it's the way of Christ. Chrysostom sets his sight, I said that part, he's outlining his vision of a distinctively Christian paideia or educational philosophy, even as he builds upon and absorbs the preceding classical paideia. You know, one commentator succinctly summarizes Chrysostom's thesis when he writes, here's what Chrysostom's after. Society does not suffer from a lack of shrewd businessmen or even from a lack of literate and educated. It suffers from a lack of virtuous men. That's the second ripple of John Chrysostom's sermon as it makes has undulating influence into the culture around him. In this sermon, Chrysostom describes the souls of young children as soft, impressionable, malleable, choosing, again, this metaphor of wax to describe their formation. He calls upon the parents and teachers, right? Teachers are merely assisting parents in shaping students' affections for all that is true, good, and beautiful. That is your calling. That's the short job description that you have, to assist parents in shaping students' affections for all that's true, good, and beautiful. So, he calls upon the parents, teachers, to be artists of the greatest skill and precision. This is a quote from the sermon, like the creators of statues, do you give all your leisure, he chooses that word, not work, he's riffing on this notion of unhurried wonder as being your primary presence in the lives of children and not your mere joyless duty or whatever the opposite of unhurried wonder would be. Like the creators of statues, do you give all your leisure to fashioning these wondrous statues for God? And as you remove what is superfluous and add what is lacking, inspect them day by day. to see what good qualities nature has supplied, so that you will increase them, and what faults, so that you will eradicate them. Chrysostom then moves into perhaps his most memorable and lengthy part of this discourse, his discussion of the soul of thy son, for the soul is in truth a city. I add that as a sub point, that you will never choose the proper insignia if you don't understand that the wax is a city. Let me further explain what he means by that. If you're still reaching, what in the world would that mean? He names each of the child's senses as a gate to the city of the soul. And he describes the care with which the parents should keep and protect those gates. Just imagine reconsidering your objectives for the year through the gates of the city perspective. I offer that not as a final lesson plan exercise necessarily, it could be interesting, but as another lens through which to look as you attend to the needs of these statues. So as the rulers of the city, dear professors and parents, it is their responsibility, your responsibility, to set up the right kind of laws to ensure good polity for the life of the city. The gate of the tongue, for example, when properly guided, will be made not of wood or iron, but of gold, with precious stones set in deeply instead of merely laid on the surface. The bolts of these gates shall be the cross of the Lord. He then proceeds to describe the faculty of hearing. We're going to fill in some blanks here on what he is reading to them. We'll get to how he fills in the gaps of understanding the soul of a child, which is your chief object, dear educators, through an understanding of the gates of the city, with a view to that wax. He then proceeds to describe the faculty of hearing, focusing on the importance of what passes through the ear gate. He writes, when the boy takes relaxation from his studies, and by the way, you can find a sermon in the writings of Jerome, who, you know, Latin Vulgate Jerusalem, on the education of a young girl. So you can get both sides. Come find me afterward if you want to read that one. I can get you the name. When the boy takes relaxation from his studies, for the soul delights to dwell on stories of old, speak to him, drawing him away from all childish folly. For thou art raising a philosopher and an athlete, a citizen of heaven. Speak to him and tell him this story. Once upon a time, there were two sons of one father, even two brothers. That's Cain and Abel, right? Jacob, Esau, the stories of the patriarchs. And notice he's telling it in his own words. So I don't know if that means Chrysostom wrote the first children's Bible, but he's telling it in a more oral tradition mode in the 4th century. Once upon a time, and not exclusively from the pages of Scripture. We do both in our home, because I don't know where I'd fall on that fence yet. I'm not going to hedge my bets either way yet. Teachers should dramatically describe the tales of Cain and of Abel, of Jacob and Esau, the patriarchs, tales of divine punishment, and most importantly of all, let him hear the whole story of Joseph continually. There you go. Joseph, first and last thing you should read, and with references everywhere in between, according to John Chrysostom. Now, the third gate does not open and close, as does the mouth. It is more like, rather like hearing. It appears to be closed, yet it is, as it were, open and sins within whatever comes. Chrysostom is referring to touch and reminds us that the Christian athlete is to be disciplined. So I have some application in there about how physical education should be in the lives of a 3-year-old. Before proceeding, Chrysostom takes pause to sort of assess and clarify some conclusions, what a rhetorician might call division, divisio of the argument, right? He begins this brief section with a reminder of the components of the Platonic soul. The seat and habitation of spirits, we are told, are the breast and the heart within the breast. Of the appetitive part of the soul, the liver, of the reasoning part of the brain, how shall the various components of this child's soul be ruled by the kingly father? If the laws are transgressed, he will be stern and unyielding. If they are observed, he will be gracious, he will be kind, and he will bestow many rewards on the boy. Even so, God rules the world with the fear of hell and the promise of the kingdom. So must we, too, rule our children. Oof. I'm assuming that's controversial, and even in this room, I don't know. Let's come back to that one. Now, the account that follows is one of many. I offer this in light of the play that my children enacted on their bedroom floor that day. The account that follows is one that many that have made Chrysostom popular as a proto-social activist. In wanting to teach the child to be strong and simple and courteous, he admonishes the father to instruct the son to dispose his spirit to gentleness, something that every preschool teacher is teaching, and bid him treat his servants like brothers. Slavery is born of sin. He's talking about slaves in the home. Slavery is born of sin, Chrysostom explains, and a Christian youth who is considerate towards those slaves will in turn be beloved by them. So he's making a move on that whole. I just offer that because it's such an interesting piece of the work as you study this from every perspective. There is a way, my point is this, there's a way to teach gentleness, preschool teachers, such that you are training up the liberator of the future. That is Chrysostom's point. And that in turn, the love that will be reciprocated by them is the very charity of the gospel that guards your hearts and mine, both with our love to God and one to another. An interesting little moment that connects the entry point of my institution is PK3 with a future calling and vocation. Take it or leave it. All right. Now this leads Chrysostom to what may be the most significant quotation in the work, as I've found it quoted elsewhere in Christendom, and one that another scholar finds particularly telling with respect to the seriousness of Chrysostom's attempt at establishing a Christian paideia, educational philosophy, in this world that begins with itty-bitties. Toward the end of the work, Chrysostom describes in painfully familiar terms the way in which children, three-year-olds, become fractious over incidents which seem so trivial to their parents, such as the loss or the breaking of a writing implement. Chrysostom gives expert advice on dealing with such crises, or he gives advice on how to maintain sanity, if not how to navigate the waters of division in your classroom. He breaks off and he says, I am not speaking of mere trifles. We are discussing the governance of the world. It's another reference back to small gestures and impressions upon the wax of the mold of the lives of these children in your classroom, of gentleness, for example, will in turn mark the way the world will one day be governed. In chapter 79 of the address, it's a multiple chapter, they're short chapters, but they're long. It's, man, Episcopalians are missing out on, I mean, I get like 12 to 15 minutes to preach. This guy got some time to preach. In chapter 79 of his sermon, Chrysostom writes, and I'm getting past the sermon, we're getting on to other things here, but I can't help but gift this to you. He writes, and, quote, "And let us guide the conversation to the kingdom of heaven. And to those old or men of old, pagan or Christian, who were illustrious for their self-restraint, let us constantly flood his ears with talk of them." Here, Chrysostom betrays his distinctively Christian variation on a pagan theme. Education is primarily about moral formation with a view to the kingdom of Christ. Another commentator says that the moral purpose of education is more important than anything else. So he can, like Justin or St. Basil, quote historical examples from the pagan world that are worthy of emulation. Diogenes, Aristides, Archelaus, teacher of Socrates. Virtue will be cultivated both by story and by emulation. That's, if there was ever, that, I mean, it's the example from Barbara Elliott's book that I gave, the Canatella story and beyond. Joseph, your job with three-year-olds is mimetics, from which we get imitation. And I'm not giving a talk on mimetics today, but mimetics are crucial to your PK3 program. We can get there in a minute on what is involved in mimetic practice. Okay, in imitative practice, emulation. Chrysostom is not proposing that the details of Cain and of Abel and of Jacob and Esau, or even of Joseph for that matter, as fact-finding activities for the biblically illiterate, though the details certainly facilitate his greater purpose. The life of Joseph exists to transform the passions of young men into the self-restraint befitting of one in search of the kingdom of heaven. So in some ways, you're giving a gift to every other teacher who will come after you by predisposing already some of those predispositions and habits toward the self-restraint that's quiet for the story and then belly laughs at the end as we fall off the front of the couch and tear up pictures and throw them around. All right. In fact, Chrysostom ends his address with yet another reference to Joseph, as well as Daniel, as well as Jacob, as well as Solomon, as well as Samuel. Each is an example of the duty of a young lad to pray with great fervor and contrition. The young men noted in Scripture were known for prayer. What are the young men known in your school for, type? And then what habits and routines and liturgies and patterns of life and content-rich stories and games and play can we do to achieve that particular end of a life of great fervor and contrition and prayer? He then unites these two exhortations, both emulation and prayer, in a single summary sentence. Let the boy be trained to pray with much contrition and to keep vigils as much as he is able, and let the stamp of a saintly man be impressed on the boy in every way. Herein lies at least one of the most distinctively Christian innovations on classical paideia, classical educational philosophy and import. It is prayer. Classical paideia may cultivate a respectable Hellenist through a kind of habitually built virtue, but Christian paideia cultivates a loving disciple through spiritual habits of prayerfully sought after wisdom. And it begins with my three-year-old, if not before. Right? So, step three summary. Be a good king or queen in your classroom by pointing little ones to the king. Let me end quickly. What happens in my mind, I'm not going to go through everything. Dickens is a hero because of his attention to children in his books. As you know, he would wander the streets late into the night to observe the street folk and the young boys, the orphans who did not yet have orphanages in which to live. So there'd be packs of street boys that would run around that would become whole novels of his. And so what you have in the writings of Dickens has always been my mental picture of the pre-K-3 classroom. It is a carnival of liberty. You know, Dickens was quoted as saying, no man encouraged his characters. Chesterton wrote that no man encouraged his characters as much as Dickens. I am an affectionate father, Dickens says, to every child of my fancy. And he was not only an affectionate father, he was an ever-indulgent father. The children of his fancy are spoiled children. They shake the house like heavy and shouting schoolboys. They smash the stories to pieces like so much furniture. When we moderns write stories about characters, our characters are better controlled. When we experience the ungovernable sense of life, which goes along with old Dickens' sense of liberty, we experience the best of the revolution. I have to harness that with quiet times of prayer. But the carnival of liberty, where each child, not merely of your fancy, but of full reality, because they're now enrolled, where they sit at your dinner table every night. Must play with a view to the great carnival of liberty that is ours. All things have been freely given to us through Jesus Christ, right? And so the poet says, give us but one thing more, ever grateful hearts. A good Anglican poet, yeah. George Herbert, can't live without him, right? All right, number one. So, postscript application. Here's probably why you came. But each of these comes from my lecture somewhere. I wanted to give you a basis for what I say, other than it kind of worked well last year. Like there are actually writings in the church 1,600 years old that can inform what you do every day and how you make even curriculum selections. That's there. It's for you. I found it on the internet. It was awesome. All right, number one, play with a view to greatness. Great men and women lead exaggerated, epic-making lives that are often, when you read them, dismissive of the prevailing balanced or holistic lifestyles around them. That actually matches pretty well the extreme nature of children wanting to play in any one direction to an obnoxious end. There's a way we need to shepherd that. We gotta shepherd the daylights out of that. But that actually matches well. To these great few, we owe the great shifts oftentimes in cultural tide, because they hold to a bedrock of moral principles. They have come to terms with their own conscience, which means they were probably had a great PK3 teacher, and they have courage. Fair is their prize. Great is their hope. A friend and fellow head of school has written that a classical curriculum does not propose that a student merely shake hands. Nice to meet you. Develop, some passing acquaintance with the greatest thinkers, the greatest artists and saints and prophets, but rather that he becomes so wholly habituated to their thoughts and words, their prayers and psalms, their masterpieces of art and music, that should be throughout your pre-K-3 classroom, that he himself becomes like those great people. So you should choose play activities with a view to greatness, and don't apologize for a moment of it. And it's going to be simple. I mean, if I had taken a picture of that scene on the floor, clearly my words have embellished the moment. I mean, think of the most simple design using blocks. But it was with a view to a great champion of the faith that they wanted to imitate in a small way. It was exaggerated, right? I mean, how did they know to put the stormtroopers in rehab and have Chewbacca be the hand holder as they throw up going through these withdrawals? it's because their play was highly informed by this one story I read over brownies at dessert. Okay, number two. Get a Land of Nod catalog and make your headmaster buy a few tent castles, sand tables, and dress-up clothes so they can play the part even as you read the most noble parts that they could ever live. That needs some money spent. So you need to start hustling people like me for some cash to go get it. And it needs to be beautiful. We're a hand-me-down school as much as any along the way. Like, I have everybody's 27-foot sectional that they pulled out of their man cave and dumped in our parking lot because they thought it'd be this great write-off. Like, what am I supposed to do with this massive sectional? Get some Land of Nod catalogs and order, I mean, within your budget. That's a shout-out to any heads of schools. I mean, keep it within budget. Anyway, that's going to be key. And we've got some of that in our PK3 classroom, and some of which we just made a wish list as we started the program and said, parents, what would you love in your dream classroom for this? And they brought it to us. I'd love for them to have this, and I don't have room for it in our house anyway. Like, great. You can have the castle in the classroom so that I don't have to have it in the shared bedroom. Hey, not a bad day. Number three, get a copy of a simple catechism. Teach them the first 10 questions and answers while they work puzzles and just chant their hearts out while they're doing it. Then spend the rest of the year asking them different kinds of questions that will require those same 10 answers to begin building the universal nature and application of theology in their lives. And that's going to come also through the stories that John Chrysostom's already told you to tell as well. So that when you say, you know, I think I've seen most of what this community uses. Who made you? God. What else did God make? God made all things. Why did God make you and all things? For his own glory. How do you glorify God? By loving him and doing his commands. And then it goes on. There are so many questions that can be asked for which those four answers are satisfactory that you begin addressing how pervasive the reign of God Almighty is in this world and in their play and in the moral imagination that's going from peanut to ocean sized. We play that game all day, every day, wherever we are. Number four, you probably need to buy a world-class library for the classroom that ranges from Dr. Seuss to the stories of the saints or heroes of the faith or whatever you describe, that venerable quality of Christian hero that is worthy of emulation is the very definition of why mimetics exist, why imitation exists. Eighth Day Books website and their store and any of their tables are going to be filled with that stuff. So I have an entire shelf in my home that we read. That's everything from like formal breviaries, like really off the charts, like monkish stuff, where they're following the lives of people you've never heard of, just because there's some good stuff in there, and then there's some stuff And then to Ethel Pachocki's work. She's a Catholic hagiographist who writes for children in the most accessible and beautiful way. There are Reformed publishers that do this and everything in between. So find those sorts of classroom materials and read them daily. Okay. Number five, hire brilliant teachers who are well-read, say their prayers, know Bible stories you've never heard of, and know how to play really, really hard. Yeah, don't we always read that? No, they are actually filling our hallways. Number six, only have the three-year-olds on campus twice a week. Some of our three-year-olds are on the campus 4 days a week, but they are the exception to the rule. We've largely encouraged our parents to more, you know, they belong at home if at all possible at that age. I think I can just come out and say that. But if they come all 4 days, so we do our 3-day week, 3-year-old program is part of our blended model. So it's either Monday, Wednesday, or Tuesday, Thursday. And they're home the rest of the week. And we have scheduled activities for home days that our professor writes and puts on RenWeb. And you can look at it. Here's a way to riff at home today on what we did in the sandbox yesterday. Lesson plan uploaded. All that's fun stuff. We can talk about that in a minute. I'm done, I think. Go outside as much as possible. We are on quite an acreage. We have several campuses, each of which has outdoor areas. And that is the gift for those souls. They are fully occupied with you sitting on a rug with them for an hour. And I don't know why you need to be hurried. I mean, we'll spend an hour out there. We do teach the beginnings. I need to give you some of this, of SWR and some math facts in our class. That's just not the most important thing we've done, so that's why I didn't focus on it. Like, that stuff's happening. We're catechizing, we're reading stories, we're doing phonograms, math facts, where they're reciting onesie, twosies type stuff. That's all happening. It's not daycare by any stretch. But it's also largely fronted with moral formation. Number 8, teach them formal prayer times in which they can participate. They can say the Lord's Prayer beautifully. They can sing the doxology to Old 100th, as referenced in the Getty Talk. They can actually sing a lot. In fact, you should sing all the time because they love it. And you should buy them dance shoes. You should let them dance in music class. We teach dance to the same kinds of music that the Gettys are known for. Their jam session later that he referenced, that Irish pub sound that you find through solfege methods and through Kodai method, all that stuff is on old English folk song. You know what I'm talking about when I say solfege Kodai method? If you don't, pick it up and make your music teacher start learning some of that. It's all based on English folk music. And they will dance their hearts out to that stuff and carry with them the whole mythic nature of it. It's fun. And then just lead, dear friends, with sloppy, sloppy joy. I think I'm done. Thank you. If you have any questions, I guess come find me. God bless you for coming.